Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
Good afternoon and welcome to this afternoon's episode of Cresta in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. In this hour, we'll be talking about the biblical concepts of marriage and merriment and dancing. We are entering into that season of the year where we're going to start seeing a lot of pictures about engagements and most of all marriages. We're going to see a lot of our friends choose these days of the year when the weather is not only beautiful but also light out to get married. And we want to explore some of the biblical images and themes of marriage. So stay tuned. Throughout the whole hour, we'll be talking about this. Our guest will be Steve Ray, who will talk about this, and he is intimately acquainted with the Holy Land, Rome, and Jewish and Hebrew culture at large. He's also a student of the Scriptures, and his deep love of the Scriptures means that he knows well what the Church teaches, but also what the historical Judeo roots of marriage are. Genesis tells us that God recognized not only that man shouldn't be alone, but that he should receive for himself a covenant azer, the Hebrew word, the helper, helpmate. And so God creates Adam and Eve. The Judeo-Christian model of marriage is not a secular legal partnership. In fact, even predating the Christian revelation, marriage was never meant to be a legal partnership. It was always meant and designed by God to be a covenant bond. From the beginning of creation, God enshrined all of creation within the marital covenant. So he sanctifies this union by pouring himself into it. The Jewish language for this considers God as, quote-unquote, the silent partner in every single marriage. And so the marital obligations, the roles that the husband has to play and the bride has to play, all of these become an overflow from the willingness to make oneself a complete gift to the other for the sake of living out this commitment in the marital vows. The biblical model views marriage as the basis of not just human companionship, but also the cornerstone of universal harmony. The community is built upon the individuated bricks, if you will, of married couples and the nuclear family. And then from there, as it greatly expands, the community becomes this larger representation of married couples and nuclear families coming together to not only work towards the common good, but to experience the benefits of the common good toward their own marriage and the families that they have built. So to that end, in the Hebrew Scriptures, it becomes very clear. Marriage is the basis of survival. Marriage is the foundational framework of all of society. So we want to contemplate on that. We want to think about that a little more. And as we do, let's go to the headlines and we'll talk more about this with Steve Ray after.
Thanks, Marcus. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Tuesday, May 28th. It's the Feast of Blessed Stefan Wyszyński. Today's news is brought to you by Ave Maria University. Your vocation location is at avemaria.edu. The Vatican has issued an apology after Pope Francis's use of an offensive word in Italian regarding seminarians who identify as gay. In a meeting with Italian bishops last week, Pope Francis reportedly used an Italian expression that is a slur against LGBTQ people and said there is too much of it in seminaries. A Vatican spokesman telling reporters that the Pope, quote, never intended to defend or express himself in homophobic terms, and he apologized to those who felt offended by the use of the term reported by others. The United Nations Security Council will be meeting today following a deadly Israeli military strike in the southern Gazan city of Rafah. Noga Tarnopolsky is reporting from Jerusalem that the strike led to a fire in the Israeli-defined safe zone.
apparently something went wrong. That's what it appears to be. And that the bombs, which were not particularly massive bombs, they were regular bombs, ignited a kind of conflagration.
The weekend strike hit a camp housing those displaced due to the fighting in the region. Reports are that more than 40 people were killed. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu described the loss of civilian lives in the airstrike as a tragic mishap. The Archdiocese of Santa Fe has announced that a former priest charged in a child sex abuse case has ended his own life ahead of a court hearing. The U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of New York announcing Balazan's indictment last summer for the alleged abuse that reportedly occurred between 2012 and 2022. The 61-year-old was facing a minimum of 10 years in prison on the charges. The Archdiocese removed him from his parish in 2022 when it became aware of the allegations. From your AveMariaRadio.net news desk, I'm Steve Clark.
Good afternoon and welcome back to Cresta in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. My guest, Steve Ray. He leads pilgrimages to the Holy Land, Rome, and other sites. He's a prolific author, converted to Catholicism in 1994. He authored Crossing the Tiber, Upon This Rock, and a series of other books, including a brand new study on the Book of Genesis. He is the host and producer of the Footprints of God DVD series, and he's been to the Holy Land more than 200 times. He writes Bible studies for Catholic Scripture International, and you can visit his work at catholic-convert.com and footprintsofgodpilgrimages.com. Steve, how are you doing?
I'm doing very good, Marcus. Always good to be chatting with you about these things like that matter most, like Al always says, the things that matter most.
Amen, so, brother.
Well,
amen.
We had. I had originally suggested we do a show, not a longer one, a shorter one, on dancing and merriment in the Bible. And then we thought, you know, let's do the whole hour. And this is kind of the time of year when people are getting married. So let's do marriage, dancing, and merriment in the Bible, because they all kind of go together in the Jewish culture especially. So I thought that what we could do is kind of emphasize the biblical and the Middle Eastern way of doing things, because we're all pretty familiar with how we do it here.
Well, I would hope we're familiar at the rate things are going in the public sphere. So let's talk about marriage then from the biblical perspective. Let's start with the bigger question of what is the biblical model, God's intended plan for marriage and the family?
Well, it shows you count the number of times these things are used in the Bible. That's something I always like to do to show how important it is. If you take marriage, wedding, wed, take a wife, those kind of phrases, that's 171 times in the Bible. And the word betrothal is 20 times in the Bible. So it shows the importance of it, and it takes a big place. And when you look at it, we've got all the way from Genesis right at the very beginning. And Jesus confirms this by saying that the man and the woman were made one, and that comes all the way from the first chapter of Genesis, and marriage goes all the way through, and we see it as the high point of our future glory when there is the marriage supper of the Lamb, where Jesus Christ in love of his bride, which is the church, that's what the whole culmination is where there's this great wedding feast where we have a covenant now with our Creator in a marriage bond. So this is just rampant through Scripture from the first to the last chapters. And so it's quite important in Scripture, and it is the building blocks of society. It is not just how we procreate. Let's say if there's no marriage, male and female, and sexual relations, there's no kids. We die out in a generation. But the fact is that God made the family this building block of society. It is the main structure of society, and it is the way that we procreate children into the next generation. It's the way we people heaven, so to speak. And the marriage also is, it's not the political government that's the main structure of society. It's not even the church. It's the husband and a wife and a family. That is the basic building block, like the DNA of society. And it's no wonder that the devil and the secular world who's out, they just try to destroy that along with the whole issue of life. It's like a double-barreled shotgun against against culture is you first say that you can abort babies and kill people at the end of life. You take away the dignity of life and then you destroy marriage. It's like a double barrel shotgun. You really have aimed at the whole criteria, the foundation, the importance, the building blocks of human civilization. So marriage is right there in the middle of it. And in biblical times, they did it with great merriment and dancing as well.
Right. So going back to, say, the writings of the rabbis in the Talmud, it's very clear that there's this correlation between this language of universal harmony and the marital vows. The Jewish people, the Hebrew people, always saw that in getting married, God was present. This wasn't just two people entering into a kind of legal social contract. The biblical model is that, no, you, me, and God, and so I have professed these vows, and God himself holds me accountable to them.
Yeah, even the yarmulke that the man, the Jewish man, wears is not in the Bible. There's nowhere it says you have to wear a yarmulke on your head. That is an acknowledgement that there's a God above. When they wear that, they always remember that God is looking down. He's part of this. And when they get married, they have even a dance. And it's God is a part of that. God is, and this is the way the Jewish people think. They view God as being very involved in their life on a day-to-day basis. Where do you think we get it as Christians? We get it right from their book. When I wrote my book on Genesis, I said, I quote a lot of Jewish rabbis and commentators in that book because I said Genesis was their book long before it was our book. And it's good to understand how they view it. And they also view the very same, that there's a covenant here being made. And the Jewish people have always, one of the reasons that they have survived, I think, through all the trials of their life. And near 2,000 years ago, they lost their temple and lost Jerusalem, and they have basically what they call the diaspora. They have been wandering around the earth without a homeland for 2,000 years and without a common language. And yet, look at when they're still a force to be reckoned with, the Jewish people. They're still there. They still exist. They still are strong. Why? Because I think bottom line is exactly what you just said. They understand the importance of family, and they understand the importance of God's involvement in the family. And if you see Jewish people today who are wearing the yarmulke and they know they're Jewish, it's because for 2,000 years, their families stayed faithful to the traditions and they stayed faithful to this whole idea of marriage as a covenant and a family is sacred. Even when you watch the movie Fiddler on the Roof, I love the movie Fiddler on the Roof, and the fiddler is the Jewish tradition. And when they're getting kicked out of Russia, out of where they're staying, the fiddler towards the end, where they're all packed on their donkey carts and they're leaving their village, the question comes, should we give up this Jewish way of life? Should we give up this Jewish God and our whole view of marriage and tradition, or should we keep it? And Tavia looks back and he sees the fiddler on the roof, and the fiddler is saying, can I come with you? Because the fiddler represents the tradition. And Tavia looks at him and he looks around and he says, oh, come on, let's go. And so the fiddler jumps down and he joins him. In other words, all through their history, the Jewish people have kept this tradition of theirs, of God being involved in their life, of there being one God, of marriage. And that's why they still exist today. There's only 16 million of them in the world. But they still exist and are strong because of this whole tradition.
In fact, just talking specifically about marriage, Steve, when you take a look at Jewish weddings, there are certain traditions they do that harken back to the fact that no matter how secularized they become as a family, they are inherently a godly Jewish people, like the smashing of something of glass, which reminds them of the destruction of the temple, or this language of at the end of every Passover, the end of every celebration next year in Jerusalem. And you've seen this firsthand.
Oh, yeah. Yes, when I talk to somebody and they said, we're going to go on a pilgrimage with you, I always say, next year in Jerusalem. So that's what the Jews say to each other. Now, I am more familiar with the Christian Palestinians' weddings than I am the Jewish. Mm-hmm. I have not been to a Jewish wedding. I have been to, and I think that these are very representative of weddings in the time of Jesus, is two weddings that we've gone to in Nazareth, and we're going to another one, my wife and I, my son Jesse and his wife, and we're taking five of our grandkids. We're going to go in August of this year. We're going to a wedding in Nazareth, and I'm going to take my grandkids on a little mini pilgrimage. But it's very different than what we do, and their weddings are 7 days, and let me just run through this, and we'll do the dancing and the merriment part on the second half. But
okay.
this is having been to these, I have four kids. I've been married 48 years myself. This year will be 48 years, and we've been married. And I had four kids, and our weddings were about 24 hours. You know how we do it in America. You get together on Friday night. You have the rehearsal dinner. Everybody practices what they're going to do and where the priest is going to stand. Okay. Then you get up the next morning. Everybody gets dressed, and you go to the wedding. And then you have the pictures taken, and you have the big reception where everybody eats and dances and has a good time. And you go home, and you say 24 hours later, oh, I'm exhausted. But this is, imagine in these days, and it's this way in Jesus. You look at the wedding of Cana, they ran out of wine after several days of this wedding, and it's a big deal. People come from all over, and you're supposed to take care of them. And so the weddings are 7 to 8 days long, and they're very extravagant. Now, it begins, though, with a betrothal. And that we could compare a little bit with our engagements. And I know this is the time of weddings and engagements during the summer. I'm going to two weddings in the next couple of weeks, and my two oldest grandsons just got engaged. So, I mean, we're right in the middle of this all.
Yeah, congratulations.
And so we'll be going to two grandsons' weddings very soon, so which we're very happy about, of course. They're wonderful Catholic girls that they're engaged to. But in biblical times, it was a betrothal. And you could compare it to our engagement, but not really, because today a boy takes a girl out to McDonald's and gives her a ring. She said yes. They go home and say, "Mom, guess what? We're getting married." I mean, I'm exaggerating a little bit to show how frivolous it can actually be here in America. And then you can break it off at any time. It's not family sanctioned, so to speak. But in this land, even today, marriages are still somewhat arranged. It doesn't mean that the parents pick a husband for the bride, but the parents have to be involved in who they marry. So, for example, in Nazareth, you've got almost 70% Muslim and 30% Christian, and so they're very protective of their young people. So I'll come back after the break. I hear the music.
Yep, thank you, Steve. My guest, Steve Ray, pilgrimage leader to the Holy Land, Rome, and other sites. We're talking about marriage, merriment, and dancing in the scriptures. So stay tuned, you don't want to miss this conversation. I'm Marcus Peter for Cresta in the Afternoon.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
I come from the other side of the tracks, see? My uncle used to have slot machines. Put one nickel in and it emptied. Boom. And I brought him home in a bag, and my mother looked at me. Where did you get all that money? I said, I won them. You didn't win them. He fixed the machine. I didn't care if he fixed the machine or not, you know?
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchak.
Do you ever wish you had more breaks from the daily demands of kids, chores, and work? Getting time for yourself is important, but a better way to stave off parental burnout is by examining how we manage our daily stress. Ask yourself this: are you able to ask for help from your family, or do you just passively, and maybe resentfully, meet everyone else's demands? Do you have routines that create a good flow in your day, or do you find yourself constantly running from one mini crisis to the next? The Liturgy of Domestic Church Life helps families create relationships, routines, and rituals that tame the craziness, make life easier on everyone, especially mom and dad. And when you do get a break, you'll be able to enjoy it more, too. To learn more about the Liturgy of Domestic Church Life, check out our books, Parenting Your Kids with Grace and Parenting Your Teens and Tweens with Grace, or visit CatholicHOM.com. I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Do you have a teenager at home who's full of potential? Too often the world is telling you to be content with mediocrity instead of raising respectful and responsible young adults with strong character. Hi, everybody. I'm Dr. Ray. If you need some help not only to navigate those teen years, but to really enjoy them. Check out my book, Standing Strong, Good Discipline Makes Great Teens, as well as my other books, on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net.
The following program is brought to you in part by MyCatholicWill.com. Surveys show that more than half of Americans do not have a will. At MyCatholicWill.com, it takes as little as 15 minutes to write your will and secure a legacy of faith. MyCatholicWill.com is the exclusive online destination for creating a Catholic will. The process of writing a will is simple and now more accessible than ever. MyCatholicWill.com, a legacy of faith for those you love.
St. Therese once told her sister Celine that when we trust ourselves and not God, our soul becomes barren and incapable of virtue. Her remedy? External works of charity. We all try to do it on our own sometimes without asking for God's help. At St. Paul Evangelization, we suggest sharing the gospel with someone who needs it. Check out streetevangelization.com to find a team near you where you can share the love of Jesus. If there isn't one in your area yet, perhaps God is calling you to start a team in your city. To learn more, visit streetevangelization.com.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
Good afternoon and welcome back to Cresta in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. My guest, Steve Ray, pilgrimage leader to the Holy Land, Rome, and other sites, prolific author of a series of books, and he also writes Bible studies for Catholic Scripture Study International, and you can find him at catholic-convert.com and footprintsofgodpilgrimages.com. So Steve, we were talking earlier about the reality that marriages are still somewhat quote-unquote arranged in the Middle East.
Yes. Yes. It, what happens is, and I'll give you the example of my friend with his daughter and his two sons. They get older and they meet somebody, and they usually meet them at church or a church event or a family event, and they like this person. Well, they can't just go and say, hey, let's start going out together without the parents first getting involved. So, for example, the young man calls the girl that we are friends with, his family, and she said, I can't talk to you right now because my father's not home. And she hung up on him, and she couldn't talk to him until her dad and parents were home. Then they had a meeting together with the family. The families got together and they talked about each other's child, and then it eventually gets to the point where the family agrees that they can court, and then they get what's called betrothed. Mm-hmm. A betrothal is not just where you get engaged. A betrothal is actually a church event, and you have maybe 1,000 people there, 500 from the bride's family, 500 from the groom's family. And so you have this big church ceremony, and then you go to a hall for a big dinner, and they all are dressed in their wedding clothes because they are now legally married, though their marriage has two parts, two steps. The betrothal, which is like the legal aspect of it, which is now it's too late, you don't back out of this. And then about a year later, the groom comes to collect the bride and take him to her house. So this betrothal, then now they're allowed to be seen in public together. Up until then, you know, you just it's not acceptable, but now that they're betrothed, everybody knows now you can be seen in public. Now a year later, then comes the 7-day wedding, so to speak. And this is just incredible because my wife and I have been a part of this, and you have like 500 to 1,000 people because they're big families. My friend has 58 first cousins in Nazareth, and his wife has 78 first cousins. Whoa. Now they all have wives and spouses and kids, and they have friends. So when you and you don't give RSVPs. People just come when they hear that there's this wedding. So they have these big meals. So, for example, the bride will bring 30 of her most important family members to meet the 500 to 1,000 of her groom's family. And then they reverse it in two nights, and 30 of his family come to meet 1,000 of her family. See, so they kind of get acquainted. And it's tribal, to be honest with you. They think in sense of tribal or family, big families. And so then we went to that party, and it's unbelievable. The dancing, we're going to talk about that in the second half here. The dancing, I'll save that for then, but it's just spectacular to watch these Arab Christians dance. They're just, it's a beautiful thing. And then they have, when on the final day of the 7 days, we're all at my friend's house, the bride's family. It was the bride getting married, and so we're all there. The men and the women are separate, and this really helps to understand John chapter 2, the wedding in Cana, because, by the way, Nazareth is only 4 miles away from Cana, so when I go to a wedding in Nazareth, I feel like I'm at the wedding in Cana. It's only 4 miles walk away. And so the men are in one part of the house, and the women are in the other part of the house. Now, these are the close relatives, the uncles, the aunts, the grandfathers, and so on, and the Catholic priest. So, and my wife was with all the women, and they were talking to her and getting her all beautiful, and they do special songs that they sing, and they go, da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, this is an Arab way of doing things. And the men were all over here in this section, and they're talking to each other. And this is very typical of what it would have been like in Cana, because the women, Mary would have been with all the women on one side, part of this, and the men would all be over here. When she finds out they've run out of wine, you have to understand the dynamic of these kind of Middle Eastern weddings. She's away from her son. The men are way over there, and the women don't mix with the men in these kind of events. So she has to leave the women, and she goes over, and I can just see her standing in the doorway and get her son's eye and say, "Come here, Jesus, come here." Jesus comes over, and this is how she informs him, see, that they don't have any wine. Now, in the middle of this gathering with the women in one part of the house and the men in the other part of the house, at one point, after we've been conversing here for several hours, the father of the groom stood up, and he faced my friend, the father of the bride. And all the men in the room sat, and they stood, and he said, "My son has come to take his bride. Do you allow us to take your daughter?" If my friend said no, the wedding is off. Because these are family affairs, they're family events. And you don't get, by the way, you don't get divorced over there. There's hardly any word of divorce, because the families are, you know, today we say, "Well, it's not my business, it's their business." They say, "Of course it's our business. That's our daughter. That's our son. Right. These are our grandkids. Of course, we're going to go talk to," and they take the husband, if he's a problem, they take him out for a walk. And they said, "If we have to take you out again, then we're not going to be as friendly the second time around." And he said, "You'd be amazed at the marriages that are restored because the family gets involved." So anyway, now the father says yes, and then the groom gets the bride, and they get in the car, and the wedding party that's in the house, it's not the thousands of people there, just the families, they go to the church. It's a Catholic church that we went to, and they have the beautiful ceremony, and they both, the bride and the groom, wear a crown. And the crown represents that they are royalty before God, and you should respect each other in that office. The man is not the woman, and the woman is not the man. They each have their own role to play in this marriage, complementary of each other, and yet they're both royalty. And the royalty represents that you to treat your wife like she is a son, a queen, a princess of God. See, and then they have their marriage, and then they go off on their honeymoon, and it's over. And everybody goes home and crashes after 7 days, and it takes them a week to recover from it all. But it just is so different than what we do here, and it's so much more family oriented, so much more so that you don't have divorces later on, and you don't have pregnancies out of wedlock over there either. It's just not acceptable. And because of the strong family involvement, you have this people control themselves, say.
Right. which goes back to what you were saying earlier, that, again, because of the strong family involvement, there's this kind of accountability to the family and then the community at large, that marriage is truly honored as the brick, if you will, the bedrock of the entire community. And so the entire community right. is involved in safeguarding the institution.
Right, exactly. And, you know, we need to do that in our country as well, us Catholic fathers. We need to step up to the plate. So, for example, I have three daughters, and they were young teenagers. They're very beautiful girls, and the guys were interested in them. And they would want to spend time with my daughter. Well, I would always say, invite them over. And mm-hmm. I'd bring them into the living room, and I'd say, Joe or Sam or whatever your name is. I said, I hear you like my daughter and want to spend some time with her. Yes, I do, sir. I says, well, good. Then you're now accountable to me because that's my daughter. And mm-hmm. I love her, and I've spent a lot of money on that. she's our daughter. And if you want to spend time with our daughter, you'll do it in groups, in a family, in church groups. I don't want to ever see you alone with my daughter in a car somewhere, in a parking lot somewhere, whatever. I said, this mm-hmm. is a community thing that you're getting involved in. And if you ever touch my daughter or treat her in a way that I wouldn't, I'll break both of your legs. And I know that sounds harsh, but you know, nope. my daughters loved it. They just, my daughter would say, Dad, so-and-so's coming over. Are you going to give him the broken knee speech? And I said, yes, I am. Any boy that gets involved with my daughters is going to get the broken knee speech. You know what happened, Marcus, is the bad guys left and never came back, and the good mm-hmm. guys ended up marrying my daughters. And they have Amen. Wonderful marriages now. But the fathers need to really step up to the plate and be a father in the family today. And I think in many ways, television and commercials and the culture we live in tell men that they're idiots and that they shouldn't be telling mm-hmm. their family what to do. They shouldn't be masculine. It's toxic to be masculine. And I just think that's all a bunch of baloney. We need to stand yeah. up, to step up to the plate and be fathers and be husbands and protect our families, because this is what right. like in biblical times and still is today in the Middle East.
Right, right. I completely hear you. Just to add on to the joke, but semi-serious, my own daughter, Therese, is 2 right now, and we just had another baby girl, Bernadette. And I'm already rehearsing some of the lines I'll be using when some of those young boys come knocking at the door wanting to ask them out. And I think right. one I've worked on is, if you break her heart, I break your legs.
That's right. So, but this is good. You need, see, your daughters are going to be lucky girls. And I'll tell you what, daughters love it that their fathers love them and take care of them. My daughters, at times, you could see maybe they weren't so happy about it at the moment, but all of them have come back and said, thank you, Dad, for what you did. You saved my life. And mm-hmm. because there were some guys that came that I knew that they weren't worthy of my daughter, so to put it in. Right. And most of the time, parents have a sense of that. You'll have a sense of that with guys. So it's, but coming back to marriage in biblical times, it was something that was very family-oriented, and it was mm-hmm. very much the father and the mother were involved, and the priests and the religious leaders in the community. And therefore, when the marriage took place, everybody recognized that this is for life. This isn't just until I don't love her anymore or until I lose right, interest right. or find a younger model. You know, this is not the way it's done in biblical times, and it's not the way it's done in the Catholic Church either. We betroth and we marry, and then that is until death do us part, because we have become one. And this is a whole picture of God and his church. Paul tells us that mm-hmm. God and his church, he loves us and he weds us. And this is a bond. We become one, in a sense. We become family. And so marriage is so important, because it even explains and helps understand the relationship with Jesus and his church.
Amen. Now, I want to begin the conversation on dancing. We're running out of time in the second segment, but I want to just open the concept of dancing, because, you know, some of us can tend to be a little Puritan about the notion, but the truth is dancing and merriment are inherently biblical notions in the Judeo-Christian revelation.
Yep. I was raised Baptist, and we had that's our right. own Baptist Ten Commandments. No drinking, no smoking, no dancing, no playing cards. And we knew that list, and my parents were very strict about it in our Baptist family. But the reality is that not only did they drink wine back in those days, they also danced and were very merry. So we'll get back to that when I can hear the music coming up again.
Thank you, Steve. My guest, Steve Ray, father of some very beautiful daughters, and he's led them biblically very well. He leads pilgrimages to the Holy Land, Rome, and other sites. Stay tuned as we continue this conversation on the biblical notion of marriage, merriment, and dancing. I'm Marcus Peter for Cresta in the Afternoon.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Support for this Ave Maria radio program comes in part by the non-for-profit St. Anthony Services. Are you shopping for mortgage products, Catholic investing, Catholic health, real estate, or estate planning? StAnthonyServices.org can help you find a Catholic professional for these needs. They regularly connect faithful citizens with faith-based professionals that share our Christian values. More information at StAnthonyServices.org or 877-LIFE-US1.
This program brought to you in part by the town of Ave Maria, Florida.
Ave Maria, a big kind of small town. A golf cart-friendly, ride-your-bike-everywhere kind of town with something for everyone. Resort-style amenities, two golf courses, shopping, and dining in our town center. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at the core of the community and a wide range of homes to meet your family's needs. Visitors are welcome. More information can be found at AveMaria.com. Ave Maria, a big kind of small town.
Hello and welcome to The Crux of the Matter. I'm Father Wade Menezes. If there's one doctrinal teaching of the Catholic Church that stands out particularly strong in this modern day and age, a teaching that everybody seems to know, both Catholics and non-Catholics alike, whether they agree with it or not, it's the teaching that priestly ordination is reserved to men alone. But this time-honored doctrine, held by the Church since the time of Christ and His apostles, in no way militates against the dignity of women, their natural gifts or vocation, nor is the fact that women are ineligible to receive the sacrament of holy orders to be viewed as a reflection against their universal call to holiness, to which all persons are called. In modern times, the Church has repeatedly and definitively reiterated the reasons why the sacrament of holy orders can be received only by men. Pope John Paul II, in his apostolic letter on reserving priestly ordination to men alone, quotes Pope Paul VI in stating some of these reasons, including the example recorded in the sacred scriptures of Christ choosing his apostles only from among men, the constant practice of the Church, which has imitated Christ in choosing only men, and her living teaching authority, which has consistently held that the exclusion of women from the priesthood is in accordance with God's plan for His Church. In actual fact, then, the Church concludes that she is not authorized to admit women to priestly ordination. In other words, the Church herself cannot change this teaching. She has not the authority to do so. And this is because the Church recognizes herself to be bound, as it were, by this choice made by the Lord Himself, a choice, mind you, which He made freely, since He shows Himself time and time again in the Gospels to not have been subject to the prevailing customs or social conditions of His time. This has been The Crux of the Matter, and I'm Father Wade Menezes. God bless you.
Good afternoon, and welcome back to Cresta in the Afternoon. My guest for this hour, Steve Ray.
pilgrimage leader to the Holy Land, Rome, and other sites. And our conversation today is on marriage and dancing and merriment in the scriptures. And Steve, when we left off, we were talking about how dancing is such a pivotal part of the Christian revelation. And you shared during the break about how you used to dance with your daughters. And I think that's a bit of a crucial thing to share to our listeners right now. So let's start there.
Yes, I think that fathers have a very unique relationship with their daughters and should give your daughters an example of how they should be treated by a young man or by a husband in the future. And now, in biblical times, the families danced. Dancing was something that was a part of the Jewish culture. In fact, the word dance is used 31 times in the Bible, 5 times in the Gospels alone. And however, that's only 31 times for the word dance, but in Hebrew there are 8 different words for dancing of different types, of twirling or movement, and dancing is basically the rhythm of bodily movements to rhythm, to show a sense of emotion and involvement. And it's something that is really practiced by all people of all times. Every culture has some sort of dance involved in it, where your body, even if we think about it, prayer and at Mass, in a way is a dance before God, because we aren't just sitting there completely still, just praying in our mind. We're crossing ourselves, we're genuflecting, right. We're standing, we're sitting, we're bowing, we're doing the sign of the cross. All of this is bodily motion. In a way, you could even view that as the dance of the liturgy. And when we're there before God, we know how to move our bodies and what to do at certain points. But the Hebrew people danced, and it was something that was very exuberant. It's a way of joy. For example, let me just read a couple passages. 2 Samuel chapter 6. David, King David, brought the Ark of God to the city of David with rejoicing. David danced before the Lord with all of his might, with shouting and the sound of the ram's horn. Can you imagine that? The king, he strips down to an ephod, which is very slight clothing, and he dances before the Lord with all of his might, shouting with the sounds of the ram's horn. Now, that also can be bad. Aaron took the golden calf, and the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. As Moses came down from the mountain with the Ten Commandments, he saw the calf and the people dancing. So see, the dancing is, it's not good or bad, it's how it's used. So it's like a hammer. A hammer can be used for good, it can be used for bad. Dancing is the same. Dancing before God, dancing in a pure way. For example, when you come to these weddings that we're going to be going to, my friend and his wife dance together. The dances that they do, even at a wedding, are all very prudent. They're all family oriented. It's not a man and a woman gyrating against each other. They're very romantic the way they dance together, but it's not erotic and it's not meant to be. And they just have this smooth movement, and families dance together, and it's just a gentle, prudent, very modest movement together. It's just something to behold. So you have Psalm 149. Let Israel be glad in his maker. Let the children of Zion rejoice. Let them praise his name with dancing, making melody to him with a harp, tambourine, and the lyre. That's like a harp. So the scriptures are full of this. I could go on and on. You've turned my mourning into dancing. See, so right. Now the interesting thing comes. Mary. Did Mary ever dance? This is a question we should ask. Now, most people, the initial reaction is no, she wouldn't dance. But I say that certainly she would. And I'll give you a couple of reasons why, Marcus. Number one, her name is Mary. Where did she get her name?
Right.
Her name
Miriam.
Is really Miriam. Miriam. And who's Miriam? There's only one in the Old Testament named Miriam. And this was one of Mary's saints. We learn from the catechism that Mary had women that preceded her that paved the way. They made the way ahead of time for the Blessed Virgin Mary. In other words, they paved the way. They were examples. In other words, you and I have saints that we like. All the Catholics listening, they have favorite saints that they call on, and they emulate these saints, right? Well, Mary did the same. She had Miriam, which is her namesake. She had Sarah and Hannah and Deborah. And in Bethlehem, when you go to I mean, it's in Jerusalem, actually, in where Mary fell asleep, the Church of Dormition, above mm-hmm. where they have a statue of her laying before she was taken into heaven. Above her is a mosaic of six different women who were examples or the saints of Mary. One of them is Miriam. And what is she known for? As soon as they came across the That's Red right. Sea, it says here, when Pharaoh and his horses were cast into the sea and with the people of Israel walked on dry ground, then Miriam, who Mary is named after, Miriam the prophet, the sister of Moses, took a tambourine in her hands, and all the women went out with her with tambourines and dancing. Now, Mary's namesake is Miriam, and Miriam is known more than anything else for her dancing with the tambourine. You mm-hmm. look up on Google, look up Miriam, and then look at the pictures. Almost all of them have her with a tambourine dancing with the holy women. And so we know that the women danced, and it was a way that they expressed their love and their honor and their exuberance. They loved God. It was a way they showed their excitement for God and their passion. It came out just not out of their lips, but it came out, their bodies also expressed that joy and the exuberance before God.
Right. And you bring up a really interesting and very pivotal point, Steve, which is that we've developed a kind of, like you mentioned earlier, that very often it's easy for us to find examples of dancing in the modern culture where it's a man and a woman behaving rather imprudently and immodestly. But dancing by itself not only is inherently biblical, but to think of the Mother of God as someone who most definitely danced because of her Jewish heritage means that there really is a reality of the celebratory life in the Christian life in terms of this practice of dancing.
Yes. I think sometimes we get this idea that in order to be a good Catholic, you have to be very somber and stern and not smiling too much. You know, we have to be very serious. But I think that there are times for that, of course. But there are other times where we dance. For example, in the Catholic Bible Dictionary, it says in the New Testament, dancing is noted at various celebrations, including birthdays, family gatherings, and weddings. Wedding feasts were known as drinking parties, and they would have wine. For example, the wedding feast of Cana, they ran out of wine, so Jesus made wine for them. How much wine mm-hmm. did he make? It was those jugs held, I'll just make it short, it was between 120 and 150 gallons. Wow. Probably the best Cabernet wine you've ever tasted, because God doesn't make junk. That had to be great wine. And so the wedding feasts at the parties of the Jewish people and of the Christian Arabs today, there'll be plenty of wine passing around, and they enjoy that wine. Jesus provided them 150 gallons of wine for that right. wedding feast. You know, and here's another example of dancing. I think it's telling, because the story of the prodigal son is a story of God the Father who's standing on his porch waiting for his prodigal son to return home. And he sees him coming over the hill. And it doesn't say that the son knocked on the door and begged his dad to let him in. It said his dad saw him from afar. In other words, he stood there all the time. He was looking down the road to see when his son would come home. And when he mm-hmm. did, guess what he did? It says the prodigal son returns to the father and celebrates. And they had a big celebration. But the older son, as he drew near to the house, heard music and dancing. Mm-hmm. In the parable, Jesus mentions a typical Jewish celebration, including dancing. Now, do you assume that the father, who was of the son, was not dancing also in celebration at this big party? He was dancing with everybody else, and that father represents God the Father. He right. made us in his image. And if he made us in his image, and we have natural inclination to dance and be exuberant and show the rhythm in our love for God and good things in life and family, don't think that that doesn't come from God himself, though he doesn't have a body, of course, but don't think that that gift doesn't come from God. And so here you have all of them dancing in the prodigal son to celebrate the return. I like to think that when one of us repents of our sins, somebody you hear goes to confession the first time after 40 years. I just heard of that happening. Just my son invited a lady he knew. He said, would you come back to the Catholic Church? And she talked with him for a while. And she finally said, I'll come with you. And he set up an appointment for confession. It was the first time she'd been to confession in 40 years.
Wow.
Now, don't you think that the angels in heaven celebrate? There's dancing. There's just this merriment over someone returning. Well, the prodigal son says yes. The father even was dancing at the prodigal son's celebration. So I think this whole idea of dancing is something that we as Catholics can embrace, but it also can be used badly too. Obviously, we know that the Salome who danced in front of Herod, that had to be a very erotic dance, and he, John the Baptist, lost his head over that one. But so dancing can
in
be
more
used
ways
for
than
good.
One.
Exactly. And dancing can be used for good, and it can also be used for evil. But we should not be afraid just because the world does things wrong and does dancing, which is erotic and sinful, doesn't mean that we as Catholics have to go swing the pendulum to the other side and avoid all of it. No, we can set the example for what merriment and dancing really is in a godly family Catholic setting.
Right. You think about Zephaniah 3:17, about the Father rejoicing over us with singing. Some translations actually have it, he dances over us with singing. And I think, like you mentioned, it's easy to develop this quasi-perpetually monastic view of what Catholicism ought to look like, when in reality, ours is a faith that calls for constant celebration. We celebrate the God who triumphed over sin and death. And so merriment and dancing are almost inherent to the revelation of our faith.
It is. And Jesus experienced everything we did except for sin. So that means all of the joyous things, all of the good things he experienced with us. He knew good food and good wine. In fact, isn't he accused of being a drunkard?
Yes.
You think about that. He's accused of that. They say that, he says, John the Baptist came neither drinking nor eating, and you said that you complained about that. You said that I came, I'm drinking and I'm feasting. Jesus did some of his best work at dinner parties. He did some of his best evangelism while he was eating with the Pharisees sinners. He didn't come to redeem the lost, he came to bring the lost back. And so he did not hesitate to have a feasting and drinking. They even said that he drank. And dancing, I'm sure Jesus danced as well, because these are the good and human things. One way we can think of what it means to be spiritual is that we live totally our human life the way God intended us to live, the perfect, holy human life. And that includes all of the joys that God gave us as well.
Right, I completely hear you. And, you know, going back to what you were saying, it's easy to take good things too far. But and we have a culture that constantly does that. In fact, a culture constantly beckons us to become nothing but hedonistic, indulgent individuals who are thrown every which way by the whims of our passions. But God gave us good things to be enjoyed.
Yep. Can you imagine Jesus, the Pharisees looking at him? He just comes out of a dinner party with the Pharisees, and they say this, and this is from the Gospel of Luke, chapters 7, 33 and 34. Look at him, a glutton and a drunkard. Jesus, obviously he wasn't a glutton or a drunkard,
right,
but he enjoyed these things of life. So I think we as Catholics should celebrate our humanity, being made in the image of God, and all the great gifts he's given us.
Thank you so much, Steve. My guest, Steve Ray. I'm Marcus Peter for Cresta in the Afternoon.
What does Oratio Dominica mean? It refers to a prayer that is, according to the Catholic Catechism, truly unique. It is of the Lord. As the only Son of God the Father, Jesus, in speaking the words his Father gave him, is the master of our prayer. In addition, as Word incarnate, Jesus, in his human heart, knows the needs of his human brothers and sisters. In revealing them to us, he is also the model of our prayer. Jesus, however, does not merely give us a formula to repeat mechanically. Jesus not only gives the words of the Our Father, he gives us the Spirit by whom the words become in us spirit and life. The prayer to Our Father is inserted into the mysterious mission of the Son and the Spirit. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo.
Learn and spread the word about the food, clothing, parenting classes, financial assistance that these resource centers provide moms, and not just for a few weeks after the baby is born, but often for up to 4 years after birth. Don't assume that just because you haven't heard about pro-life resources or efforts that they don't or aren't available, or that the church hasn't been involved. The media, and I know this firsthand from my years of experience, have been working with the abortion industry to suppress information about resources, as well as totally misrepresent or blatantly lie about what the pro-life community offers moms and families in need. And last but not least, do some homework and prayerfully give thanks to these pro-life warriors and consider becoming a pro-life warrior yourself.
Catholic Connections, Teresa Tomeo. Weekdays, 9 a.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome back to Cresta in the Afternoon. Rounding off this hour of today's program, we just had a truly enlightening conversation with Steve Ray about dancing and merriment and rejoicing in the Bible and how it all pertains particularly to the celebration of the covenant of marriage. God's plan for marriage is that man and woman ought to move from covenant to covenant, while born into the covenant shared between a father and a mother. As a young boy matures into manhood and a young woman matures into womanhood, they're called to enter into covenants of their own. The marital covenant is the most common expression of this in the church. And we are to rejoice when we enter into any one of these covenants. And so dancing, and to imagine Mary and Jesus partaking in this, is an inherently biblical reality. So let's rejoice for all the things that are so good and wonderful about our life. Until next time, I'm Marcus Peter for Cresta in the Afternoon.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio, and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMaria Radio.net. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at AveMariaRadio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at AveMariaRadio.net.